My guest today is Yasheng Huang, who wrote this fascinating book, The Rise and Fall of the East. So Yasheng, welcome to Things I Didn't Learn in School.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you so much.
So we're mostly going to talk about your book, but for people who don't know you as a preeminent and very thoughtful China expert, could you say a little bit about who you are and your background?
Yeah, sure. I'm a professor at MIT Sloan School of Management, and I teach courses on Chinese economy and business, and I've been leading an effort at my school in what is known as action learning. So we have our students work with Chinese companies and companies in other countries as part of their course deliverables, right? So this is putting our students in the context of the economies and societies they learn about in the classroom, but working there as a way to learn about those economies. And I've been doing this for the last 15 years. I've been working on...
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I started doing this in 2008. I have been working with 300 Chinese companies, over 150 companies in India. Now we just started an initiative in ASEAN countries.
Fascinating. Maybe we can send one of those interns to my company at some point as well. And where did you grow up in China, and when did you come to the U.S.? Because yeah. I'm guessing that the story here, the rise and fall of the East, of course, there's tons of contemporary academic research here, but there's an enormous amount of personal experience. And I always find it's useful to know that perspective a little bit on an author when you're understanding their work.
Yeah. So I was born and grew up in China. And the first time I left China was 1981. And then I went back to China. I worked for the World Bank, and that was the late 1980s during the Tiananmen. And as you may tell from my book, that event in 1989 had a very big impact on Chinese economy, on Chinese society, but also on my way of thinking about economic development and political development. So I always go back to that event, and it was a very consequential development.
How were you personally, where were you during Tiananmen? Were you in China? Were you outside of China? What was going, where were you at the time?
Yeah, so I was in Beijing, and on the night of the crackdown, it just so happened that some friends of mine and I scheduled for a long time ago to go outing. And we sort of rode our bicycles our bicycles away from the center of Beijing to the suburb. And then on our way, we saw army trucks and tanks. But by that time, we were already pretty blasé about troops movement. And also nobody thought that they would actually open fires on people. And so we saw the movement of the trucks and the tanks. We continued on our journey. That probably saved at least maybe some of our lives. I mean, because we would have been at the square if we didn't do that. But then by 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, we listened to the Voice of America, and we learned that the troops opened fire on the demonstrators. It was not known what scale the crackdown was, and we rode back to Beijing, and we saw the tail end of it.
Must have been heartbreaking and scary.
It was incredibly heartbreaking, incredibly scary. And also, that was one of the most exciting years of my life, to be in Beijing, to be in the middle of the agitations and intellectual ferment before the crackdown. There was a lot of incredibly interesting intellectual activities. It was the height of intellectual movement in the PRC history, the year leading up to the Tiananmen crackdown.
Right. And then for those types of organizations, you know, as regular listeners know, I started my career in Russia and saw the coups there firsthand, particularly the 93 coup. And for those organizations, those types of structures, that type of intellectual ferment is always extremely dangerous because it immediately asks questions that are not to be asked. And just one more question before we jump into the book. Now, were your parents, I always ask this of all my guests from China, and how was your family impacted by the Cultural Revolution? Was this something that impacted your parents or you or in any way?
Well, so I grew up in an intellectual family, so my parents were affected by the Cultural Revolution exactly in the same way as other intellectual families. They were sent down to the countryside to work as physical labor. My mom was sent to a pig farm, so she became a farmer to raise pigs and to slaughter pigs. And in fact, because of that experience, after she came back, she would never eat a single bite of pork.
Wow.
It was so traumatic to her. But I have to provide another perspective. You know, I was a school kid. Imagine a time when you are 6 or 7 years old and you didn't have to go to school.
Yeah. Right?
That's what happened to me. And I was not old enough to be a right guard, but I was old enough to go to primary school. But then the whole school system collapsed. So the kind of the exam system that I study in my book did not exist, right? You didn't have to take exams. You didn't have to study. You didn't have to go to school. You didn't have to listen to your teachers. And my parents were nowhere around. You didn't have to listen to them. You know, I was taken care of by my grandmother. And so it was, there's a British movie. I think the title is Hope and Glory or something like that. It was about school kids during the Bleaks of London. And they were hiding in the tunnels, and they were happy as in heaven because they didn't have to go to school. So you know, sometimes you read these books about Cultural Revolution, they were really sad stories, and they were sad. I mean, I'm not trying to diminish the severity of the whole thing. But look at this thing from a perspective of a 6-year-old. Who didn't have to go to school, who didn't have to have a teacher and a strict parent. It was heaven. We did lots of bad things, by the way. So we fought a lot.
Of course, as 6 and 7 year old boys are wont to do.
All
the, but that's interesting. Yeah. It probably get a little bit, you know, in English we'd say, well, not your grandmother, but you'd say a little bit raised by wolves, or, you know, sort of raising yourself. And that type of childhood probably very, very foreign to many of the students that you now teach. So this book is
let me just finish that. So I didn't go to school for many, many years, and by the time I did go to school. Actually, recently I found a school transcript, and I skipped 142 days in school in that academic year. And but, and this is more serious, but because Cultural Revolution destroyed the school system, it affected especially those people who didn't grow up in the intellectual family. So I was fortunate to grow up in the intellectual family. I had books, I had novels, and I had all these things that I could read on my own time, which I did. I devoured books, and I recently was looking at some of the notes that I took during that period of time. I was very impressed with myself. I read more than I do now. So that was another impact of the Cultural Revolution. Those people who had books and other intellectual assets, they read on their own, and they educated themselves, basically.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
Mm-hmm. And you probably see underneath it all, even though school can be so cumbersome, the thirst for knowledge and the curiosity is really inherent too at the same time.
That's right.
So the book is really fascinating, and there's a lot here: the rise and fall of the East, how exams, autocracy, stability, and technology brought China success, and why they might lead to its decline. Talk for a little bit. The book is every single page actually has a lot of ideas in it. It's like a very rich meal, you know, with a lot of flavors in each bite. Paint for a picture, like the people who listen to this podcast are a whole range of people all over the world. Some of them know China really well, and some of them don't know it particularly well. So paint a picture, if you will, of Xi Jinping's China. What's he like? How has it shifted the mood in China? What are these policies like? Millions of people being investigated and arrested, very prominent people getting hired and then fired. I mean, it's a real, in the time that I've been involved with China, it's one of the most substantial, abrupt shifts that I've witnessed. So Tiananmen was one that you saw early in your Cultural Revolution, Tiananmen. And this is another one of these, maybe not quite as vivid as those, but it's a big shift. So what's it like there? And what's this guy like?
So to talk about him, we sort of have to go back to the period before him a little bit, right? Because he engineered a dramatic pivot to a almost a different country now. In my book, I observed that the Chinese economy was catching up with South Korea, but Chinese politics was catching up with North Korea. Right? I mean, this is
this is so true.
This is the contrast. It is just unbelievable. But by the way, in the long run, I don't think that's going to hold. And that equation is going to break. But at the current time, this is the discrepancy between economics and politics. Tiananmen changed Chinese politics. It changed the economy to some extent, but it didn't fundamentally change the trajectory the Chinese economy was on, becoming more market-oriented, becoming more globalized. If you look at education, research, collaborations with the West, China actually accelerated after Tiananmen in terms of students going to America, students going to Europe, research collaborations between Chinese research institutes and Western research institutes. So Tiananmen definitely had a big impact on politics. The political reforms were stopped. But economically, China was still moving in a forward motion. The biggest difference between Xi and the previous leaders is that he reversed everything. He reversed politics, right? So if you think about the term limit, a constitutional term limit, and one of the sort of understated contribution by Deng Xiaoping was the political changes that he introduced. He instituted the term limit. He established a norm of mandatory age retirement. And because of those political changes that he introduced, China had two very smooth power transitions, right?
Yeah.
Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao and Xi Jinping himself. He was the beneficiary of that in 2012. He eliminated that in 2018.
To be clear, sorry, pardon me for interrupting. It was an informal verbal agreement that Deng put in, as opposed to something formal and written, like you can only have two terms.
No. It was formal. It was in the constitution.
Oh, yeah. You're right. Sorry, I forgot that he had to change it. Right. Yeah.
Yep. The mandatory age retirement was more of a norm. But,
right.
The norm was observed by three, by the leaders before she.
Right.
And in a sort of strange way by Deng himself, because he established the norm. And he always said that he really needed to retire, even though he was already very old when he established that norm, so he couldn't observe that norm himself. But he actively took himself out of the politics after 1989. She completely upended these institutional guardrails, and he reestablished life tenure, you know, like a professor, right? Life tenure. So that's one political change that he introduced. The other political change that he introduced was what I call gentle politics in my book. After the Cultural Revolution, Deng Xiaoping and other political leaders agreed among themselves the principle live and let live, right?
Yeah.
Because they saw Cultural Revolution, how brutal the Cultural Revolution was, and they sort of converted that brutal system into one that was pretty gentle among themselves, and live and let live, and they converted kind of the political enemy type of system to political rival type of system, right? So I could defeat you in politics, but I'm not going to jail you, right? By and large, he observed that with the single exception of the leader who fell after the Tiananmen, Zhao Ziyang, who was the party secretary. He was sent to the house arrest, but you know, it was probably more by his successor, Jiang Zemin, rather than by Deng himself. By and large, that norm was observed, not Xi Jinping, right? And he went after so many officials. He criminalized these investigations. According to one estimate, there were about 4 million officials who were investigated and sentenced to jail on corruption charges. By the way, you know, China became very corrupt, so I'm not trying to excuse that. But there's always a suspicion that the anti-corruption campaign was used more as a political weapon rather than simply dealing with corruption. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. Because after 4 million people were already dealt with, you kind of say, okay, you've got to stop. But it is still going on. Just the other day, they announced sacking of 2 ministers, one foreign minister, one defense minister, who came only, you know, became ministers a few months ago, right? So this kind
which seems bizarre. I mean, it seems like intrigues, like your book goes all the way back hundreds and hundreds of years, but it seems like court intrigue from hundreds of years ago, because these guys couldn't have gotten their position unless she signed off of it. Like, you're not going to become defense minister unless she says okay. And then either they didn't do due diligence, or he's putting them in place to rip them down, or it's just chaotic. Like, it's really, to the outside world, it's bizarre.
So the thing about that is, and this is the third change he introduced. The third change that he introduced was pivoting the government from economics to politics. So before him, you know, it was all about GDP, was about growth of the economy. There were a lot of problems with that. There's no question about that. And he also produced the fake GDP data. But there's a fundamental difference between GDP as a political objective and politics as the political objective. When you pivot everything to politics, you are manufacturing performance metric, right? So one performance metric is, okay, I attack you. You know, I disclose you have some of these, you know, you lack loyalty to the leader. So essentially, when you do that, when you move the government away from economics and focus on politics, you intensify these power struggles. And there's you know, theory that said, okay, all he needed to do was to consolidate his power. Once the power is consolidated, he's going to focus back on the economy. That has not happened for a good reason. The reason is that you can never get away from politics if the focus of your government is on loyalty, is on personal rule, right? Because then as an official, I always look at that, and then I will use kind of the power struggles and intrigues as a way to advance my career, as opposed to getting foreign direct investment and establishing a factory and things like that. So that is a fundamental change from the Deng Xiaoping era, and it is very damaging.
Well, particularly around that, I mean, the philosophy is such a difficult, like, if it's going to be around politics, well, what does politics mean in that system?
Exactly.
It's around a sort of kind of bizarre personal orthodoxy that and that you're as a strange set of ideas, and that you're also the Chinese version of it, the socialism with Chinese characteristics. So it's somewhat market economy, but it's also communist. Like, it seems like an awful environment to work in, because the rules are so opaque and ever shifting.
Yeah. So
actual rules, the real rules.
So this is a fundamental difference between democratic politics and autocratic politics. In democratic politics, you do have an objective metric. It is really the number of votes that you get. Right. You know, I know in the United States, sometimes it is it stops counting in some areas. But still, the fundamental currency is the number of votes that you get. In autocratic politics, the closest analogy I can think of that you readers would resonate with is office politics.
Yeah, rumors, that's exactly right. Just on a huge scale.
On a huge scale, right? The rumors you spread at the
water 90 cooler. Million people in the office at the party. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. So the office politics is sometimes considered not kosher, not okay, but you still engage in it, right? It's just human nature, right?
So it is human nature.
It is human nature, right? You say, oh, that guy said bad things about you, you know, and how do you retaliate, right? So this is what autocratic politics is, right? And the other thing about office politics is that it doesn't happen in the open. It doesn't happen according to rules and norms, precisely because office politics are not supposed to happen, right? Communist system, you are not supposed to have politics. You know, everybody is a loyal party member. You observe the party discipline. You carry out the party decisions. You're not supposed to have politics. But politics is human nature, so you can't really get rid of it.
Yeah.
And the result is office politics on a much larger scale, and the consequences are much more dire.
And he must be, the consequences are much more dire. And it's the added complication, at least from the outside looking in, is then, you know, the ancient rhythms, I would say, of Chinese court culture that go back hundreds of years with the emperor and the advisors and the exams and all that sort of stuff you talk about. So she is such a strange thing, is such a strange specimen. And I'm only focusing on him so much because just like in Russia, so much of it is about Putin right now, so much of China is about Xi. He suffers directly in the Cultural Revolution, the same thing that your parents went through. So one might think that he would then be allergic to creating anything similar, but that turns out not to be true. And that a lot of his decisions that he makes, from my perspective, don't seem particularly shrewd. Like his rapidly abandoning COVID, the economic policies, you know, creating geopolitical tension when China needs to import a lot of high-quality technology to reach its growth targets. So on that sense, he doesn't seem, quote, smart. But to manage these office politics in China, he must be brilliant because you can't get from A to B without being incredibly cunning. So it's a strange, he seems like a very strange person.
Yeah, so in AI, we debate about specific intelligence and general intelligence. I think he has some very specific intelligence in politics, in managing human psychology among the elites. I think he's extraordinarily talented in that regard. He's also very good at not showing his cards. And then when he does that, it's already too late for the other side. I think he's really among the smartest politician in the recent memory. And what's very interesting about Deng era is because so much attention was focused on economy, it was not a breeding ground for politicians who specialize in office politics. It rewarded economics, right? Economic skills and you know, maybe you manipulate statistics rather than rewarded the office politics skills. He was an exception that proved the rule. On the Cultural Revolution point, though, it's very interesting. Cultural Revolution had two diametrically opposite effects on people going through that period. It produced liberals. It also produced some of the most conservative people as well, right? So it's hard to tell which camp you belong to. For the liberals, they think about persecutions and really also the heartbreaking poverty that they saw when they were sent to the countryside. And then they began to doubt the claim of the superiority of central planning, about communism and all of that. For the conservative folks, the Cultural Revolution eliminated every single other idea except the idea of Mao. And they were exposed to that one idea. And that idea had a big impact on these people, right? And so it's Cultural Revolution is not a very good predictor of which side you end up on.
Right.
And I think the issue goes deeper, the psychology and those things. We just can't really tell which, because I know people who are on both sides of the aisle. They went through similar experiences, but they came out very, very differently and almost the opposite of each other. Only much later do we learn that she ended up on the other side of the aisle.
Right. And last point before we move off that, I want to turn to, because you had some really interesting critiques of U.S. policy that I thought were fascinating. Just one last question on Xi. You mentioned in the book, which I found really interesting, so this is more of like a insider's China type of thing, but some of the most notable officials inside the Chinese bureaucracy who were seen by the West as people who were being close to China and were more liberals, and I was thinking of people like Wang Shishan and maybe a little bit like Lu Jiwei, they were all the people that interacted with like top Western outsiders, and they seemed to be representative of a camp that was at least towards the South Korean style economic liberalization. But you point out in the book that even these people who looked like they were very close to Xi and looked like they were sort of interacting with the West in a way that would be mutually beneficial, they too were victims of Xi's office politics. And if not them specifically, then people on their staff and around them, sort of like as a warning. So I just try to imagine having the job of those people. And on the one hand, you're meeting with like the head of Goldman Sachs. And on the next hand, you're dealing with being investigated by your boss's henchmen. So it's, you know, what do you make of the fact that she is both hired and promoted, certainly Wang Shishan, but that is investigating him at the same time? I mean, it's a lot to take in.
Yeah. So Wang Shishan is a very good example of that bifurcated nature of Chinese politics. To Hank Paulson, to others, you know, he was very cosmopolitan, very enlightened, you know, thinking about market economy, Wall Street talk, and all of that. For those who are interested in him, there's actually a YouTube video of him. It's all in Chinese. I actually hope that somebody will translate it into English. A long speech that he gave at the Party School conference. It was an unadulterated speech. And it was like 2 hours long or something like that.
Wow.
It was one of the most fervent ideological talk that you hear from any official about how correct the CCP has always been, even during the Mao period, right? How Mao essentially created or seeded the modern economic takeoff of China, and how, you know, all these bad elements in the society wanted to westernized Chinese society, we got to go after them, and all of that. That was an incredible speech. And you know, it is a perfect illustration of the contradictions and the complexities of that system. Even a person as cosmopolitan, as sophisticated Wang Qishan, who has to do this. You know, I couldn't tell, you know, which side of him is his real self.
But and I maybe he doesn't know at this point.
Yeah, well, so you also brought up another point that, you know, he, during the first term of Xi Jinping, he was moved to a part of the Communist Party system that investigated other people, right? 4 million people, the number I cited, many of them were investigated by the commission that he led. And now there are rumors and speculations that, you know, maybe something is going on with him as well, right? So, but we have seen this in history before. I cited a data in my book that vice ministers of public security, many of them became the victims of the ministry that they led. They began to be investigated. And then one security official in Chongqing municipality who executed many people in his career, he got executed himself, right? I think this is a tragedy of the system. And at the end of the book, I propose this thought experiment, and I borrow from John Rawls about veil of ignorance. You know, if you're not sure whether or not you end up on the Politburo or you end up in jail, which system would you support? I asked that question, and I really want more Chinese elites to ask that question. If the system cannot guarantee the safety of intellectuals, it cannot guarantee the safety of the officials, right?
Yeah.
So I do hope that more and more people can see that point.
Yeah, I thought it was a really profound point that you raised, and I hadn't quite thought of applying that concept of Rawls to China, but I thought it was very thoughtful. I want to turn to the U.S. policy in a second, but were you scared at all writing this book and putting out these critiques in this way? In other words, given the history of that violence, and also how assertive, put aside China specifically, but Soviet systems can be, so, and I'd put, you know, Russia and China in that same camp, Soviet systems, other countries as well, but Soviet systems can be to independent thinkers. And you've got a prominent space, you know, you're at MIT and Sloan, and the Chinese secret police has been more aggressive recently. So did you think, were you uncomfortable at all publishing some of this, or were you just like, it's fine?
No, I hope that the readers can tell when they read the book, I'm balanced, right? So I do not advocate overthrowing the system, and I do not advocate, and I, in fact, my view of the system has evolved a little bit. And I see some of the plus sides of the system as well. And I also see the risks and the dangers of making sudden move to pivot, you know, immediately to a democracy and that kind of thing. What I do argue in my book is, even if you want to keep an autocratic system, the way to have a successful autocratic system is to allow some flexibilities and some space, right?
Yeah.
Rather than a watertight system. So this is where I worry about the current development. I'm not objecting to, you know, I prefer democracy. I prefer to live in the democracy, and I support democracy. But I'm not going to say that a democracy is a universal value. Everybody should have it. And you know, I advocate a system that respects the tradition of the culture, the tradition of the history, legacy of the history, and the preferences of not intellectuals like me, but also the majority of the people, I advocate that system. But I also argue, and through data and evidence rather than through ideology and values, that a more open system, even under a more autocratic setting, gives you economic growth, gives you technological development, improves the livelihood of the common people, right? So my critique of the current development, it is not, oh, it's a totalitarian system, it's really morally right. reprehensible. I actually view the current development as bad for the system itself, because right. it's not generating economic growth, and therefore it is not generating the kind of resources you need to maintain the system. And I worry about now we are seeing some evidence now that I worry about the government running out of the money to pay pensions and retirees and medical bills. That cannot possibly be good for the system that they have, right? So here I contrast with Soviet Union. Did right. Soviet Union collapse because they didn't believe strongly in communism? No, they collapsed because they didn't have any entrepreneurship. They didn't right. have GDP growth. They didn't have globalization. And it was fortunate for the Communist Party itself to open the door to private sector, to open the door to foreign investors, to preserve the autonomy of Hong Kong and using the Hong Kong as a way to raise money, to import business skills and know-how, right? It was incredibly fortunate for the CCP to have done these things. So my critique is really critiquing the deviation of a successful formula that they figured out themselves, rather right. than saying, oh, you should go all the way to the United States, right? So I think there are people in China who would resonate with that argument. And we're going to get to the U.S. later. My biggest critique of the U.S. is that they craft their critique of China in ways that do not resonate with the Chinese people.
Let's turn to that right now, because I thought that was a really interesting. I actually thought that what I read your thing made total sense, knowing China not as well as you, but I thought your critiques of what you're saying of if U.S. policy just tried a different tactic, it would be much more productive. So talk about that some. Talk about that some.
Well, so we often hear the critique from the U.S. about human rights in China.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So what do they do? They meet with Dalai Lama. They praise the dissidents. Right. So here's the problem. You know, whatever you think about Dalai Lama, the simple fact is that 99.99999% of the Chinese have a very negative view of Dalai Lama.
Uh-huh.
You may say that's not fair, but that's beside the point, right? Because right. if 99.999% think that he's not a good person, you can't really change their mind.
Right.
And so we have this habit of defending human rights of a very few people, right? Like right. one single individual, Dalai right. Lama, or a few dissidents, or sometimes you hear the critique that U.S. has of other autocratic countries, oh, you don't treat your homosexuals right, LGBT rights and things like that. Let's look at the Western history, right? the West evolved from autocracy to democracy by first defending the rights, or actually getting the rights of the majority of the population.
Right.
Women's suffrage. Well, first it's universal.
Like the aristocracy of the 18th century, yeah, that they get some rights.
It began with the few, right? The kings and the aristocrats. And then the rights began to be extended to male, right? No matter what your socioeconomic class that you belong to. And then women, mm-hmm, right? Once those issues were resolved, then we began to extend the rights to ethnic minorities, mm-hmm, and maybe newly arrived immigrants. So mm-hmm, and now LGBT and all of that.
Mm.
Our history is moving from majority to people who may not be in the majority, but who are still a substantial block of the population,
right,
and now to a very few people, and even to animal rights, right? So that's the trajectory that the West itself has been on.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're doing exactly the reverse when we take up that conversation with Arabic countries and China.
Right.
What about LGBT rights?
Yeah.
But the majority of the people there don't have the rights, and you don't speak up for them.
Right.
And so again, I'm not against LGBT rights, not in the least.
Yes.
But here's the problem, right? It creates a perception problem in those countries where people say, oh, you only care about Dalai Lama. You don't care
right,
about these few political things. You don't care about me. I'm the peasant, right? I constitute, 50-51% of the population. You never take up my cause.
Right.
But last time I got evicted from my house, you didn't say anything, right? So that argument doesn't even resonate with the intellectual and business elites. It produces an easy impression that the U.S. takes up these issues with China because U.S. means bad things to China. They really are looking for things to contain China, to stop the economic growth of the country, rather than thinking about the general broader welfare of the people there, right? So in my book, I kind of laid out that argument, and I just argue that the whole setup is wrong, right? And it is very frustrating. Now, this year, I live in Washington, D.C. It's very frustrating that the kind of message I try to convey, I find it very difficult. I've been trying to say these things for a number of years, and I can't convert people to that.
You converted me reading it. I thought it was persuasive. The other point you made there, which I thought was a good argument, which you don't hear, is that China railing against globalization and the Western way and these types of things and the instability. You said basically, listen, China's the biggest beneficiary of these systems and changes. Yeah. Why should it be so anti them? It's gotten, income per capita from here to here. And I thought that was interesting way too of just saying, listen, in the interests of your lower middle class having rights and economic improvement, those are the things that we're after. And that's that would be a much more difficult message to fight back.
Yeah. So I let me make that illustration very concrete. In the first meeting between high-level officials between U.S. and China, after Biden became the president, it was in Alaska. Chinese foreign minister was there. Anthony Blinken and Jay Sullivan were there. So what they said to the Chinese is, you are challenging the international order. Challenging the international rule, we defend the current international order and rule. So I'm not saying that's wrong, factually speaking. Mm-hmm. But why can't they say the same thing in a different way?
Right.
Why couldn't they quote Deng Xiaoping?
Right.
Who famously said, the countries that became friends with the United States got rich.
Yeah.
The countries who got who were friends with Soviet Union got poor. Right?
Yes.
The countries who became friends with the United States basically came under the U.S. rule, order, right? International order that the U.S. created that benefited those countries as well. China is the single biggest beneficiary of this system, right? And it's just amazing they don't point out these basic facts.
Yes.
And as an argument, I'm not saying that you can persuade the foreign minister of China to change his mind, but that would resonate.
Yeah, with, particularly if it got out on WeChat or something like that, absolutely. It would be super powerful. Yeah,
it would be super powerful, right? And so I think when we have these announcements or pronouncements and statements, we always need to think about the audiences, right?
Yeah.
And there are two audiences. One is the officials that you deal with at the negotiating table. Those, I actually believe, they're not that important because they cannot really change Chinese foreign policy unless Xi Jinping tells them to change, right? So no matter what you say to them, that's not going to matter. But what you say may matter in terms of affecting the opinions of the Chinese business, economic, and educational and intellectual elites, right? And in the long run, that's going to matter.
Yeah,
in the long run,
for sure. The so the podcast is called Things I Didn't Learn in School, and it's I think about your journey, you know, Cultural Revolution, Tiananmen, and then being an academic here, writing these books, studying these things. So, if you were to sort of step back and look at that journey, or focus on this book, what are some of the biggest learnings that you take away that weren't sort of things that you learned through traditional education, but you've come to believe are true about how the world works or how life works?
Yeah. So I think one thing we need to be humble about is that the world is really complex.
Yes.
And it doesn't fit with a simple narrative. And we need to be flexible in terms of how we think about the things, how we think about the world. And the other is that I think ideology is very harmful. If you approach everything from an ideological perspective, it is harmful. You know, I'm not going to say I'm free of ideology. I just said that I support democracy. I support human rights. But if before I supported these things because of values, now I support these things on the basis of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to look at the evidence now, right? I think those systems are actually better at protecting the safety of human beings,
mm-hmm.
enhancing the welfare of the human beings. So this is where I do have a major debate with people who argue that Chinese economy grew because of autocracy, because mm-hmm. of authoritarian system.
Mm-hmm.
And my argument is that that's actually quite wrong way of looking at it, because China has had autocratic system for centuries, and their economy didn't grow. It was precisely under Deng Xiaoping. The system didn't become democracy, but it became a little bit more open.
Yeah.
So in my previous book, I call it directional liberalism. It was moving toward a more open system, even though it never got there. It was that movement that opened up businesses and entrepreneurship and unlocked creativity. Suppose that you didn't make that move, then the Chinese economy would not have taken off, right? So in terms of the way that I think about these things, I believe those are the right basis to state your belief, right? Rather than, self-evident truth, right? So right. Things like that. Well, okay, maybe it's self-evident to you, but it's not self-evident to others. You have to make a persuasive argument. And the way to do that is to do good scholarship, to marshal evidence, marshal data, and construct the argument with logic, with a narrative that both sides can agree upon, right? So you may believe in autocracy, I may believe in democracy, but one thing we agree on is the power of data, power of evidence, and power of logic. Once we agree on to those principles, then we can resolve our differences, right? So I prefer that way to propagate an idea. If autocracies do show up as performing better than democracies, then I need to rethink about my value.
It's very wise. I also offer, so you've been incredibly generous with your time, and I really found the book quite fascinating. I always ask all my guests if they want to, you don't have to, but if you have any questions for me, because I always feel like after an hour of me asking you questions, I ought to offer the same return. So
I mean, how would you bring your Russian perspective, the rich knowledge that you have on Russia, to the China question, right? So where the country is now and why these two countries, China and Russia, cannot quite shake off their past, right?
I think it's two frameworks that I find for me are helpful to organize that. First thing is I look at China as basically having Chinese cultural hardware and Soviet software. So the core things about the culture, particularly the language and how that's taught and what that does to organize the education system, that's thousands of years old. And of course, the number of people that are literate and educated has shifted over time, but that's a core part, and that'll only change very slowly. And that's one key building block to understanding China. And then another key thing is the Soviet software. And the Soviet software is, of course, in common between the two places. And so I find that's the structure, the secret police, the motivations, what they do well, what they do poorly. It's very similar. The other thing that I think is helpful for understanding both of them is that I think both places are struggling to modernize in the broadest sense of the word. So if you look at the traditions that each of them have that are dominant to the political decision-making, but it also could be company and family, I would describe them as largely agricultural ways of thinking. Because agricultural society has a certain organization that is inherent to create the food to allow people not to starve. And they're quite rigid what those formulas are. And they're thousands of years old because they're designed to solve those problems. Once you begin to modernize, it creates chaos with those systems. That the minute you begin to introduce trades and telegraphs and airplanes and then communication, it disrupts what those social organizations are. And you really need to reorganize around a different system. And I think it's very hard to do. And that's fundamentally the struggle both of them are having. Europe, it wasn't easy to do that either. You had lots of civil wars and religious reformations, but it happened a little bit more slowly, and it happened over roughly 500 years. And these changes, to my mind, really started, you know, in China, the old system only collapsed about 100 years ago, 1912, and in Russia, literally 100 years ago, 1917. So it's very recent, the effort to be able to bring modern notions into these societies. And so I think the thing that underlies them both is that traditions that essentially died in Europe in the Middle Ages are still alive and well. And that's what's so bizarre about them. They have space stations and nuclear weapons and all this type of stuff. But culturally and politically, the traditions are still medieval. And that's really odd for people to understand unless they've spent a lot of time there. I think it's one of the hardest things for Americans that I know who are very smart people struggle to understand about those places. Like, how can Putin run a place like that and then blow up somebody who he worked with on an airplane? Like, it's like, well, but if you study the way kings work, there's no surprise. That's exactly how it works.
Yeah. So Paul, can I add?
So those are my two thoughts.
Yeah. So I add an observation that is very complementary with what you just said. One commonality that I see in these two countries is that you talk about tradition, culture, and ideology. It is that there's still this sort of a hierarchical order, right, of what constitutes as important things. And essentially, the kind of this, the view that nation, right, nationhood, country, you know, these are really, really important stuff, right? Glory, conquest, grandeur, right? The grandeur of the palace, Kremlin, right? The grandeur of Chinese Great Hall of the People, you know, the Olympic ceremony and all of that. And so there's just sort of prioritizing those things rather than individual welfare, right?
Yeah.
And that, to me, is a striking difference between what we loosely call Western kind of value system and that, you know, I'm not going to say Eastern, but that, the other, almost like a continental value system that prizes abstract high level things as opposed to individuals, right? And it's just conquering Ukraine, you know, invading Ukraine, you know, exactly what does that do? Even if you're successful, what does that do to the average Russian person? It would do nothing, probably mostly on the negative side.
Well,
right?
in this type of world, it's, I mean, in the old world, what it's doing is allowing you to get more wheat.
Which is
a Catherine the Great style goal. Okay. But in the modern world that is dependent on income and credit, it cuts you off completely from global borrowing and finance. And so it's disastrous.
It's disastrous. And if you want to get more wheat, you just become a more smart trader on the Chicago Commodities Exchange, right? So you don't have to sacrifice the lives of the Russian men to do that. So that's such an antiquated thinking. It's
an archaic way of thinking.
Yeah.
So they both share it. I think Xi and Putin both share it. Yeah, and they're convinced they're right. So to your point that the world is complex, they don't see it as that way. They have this simplistic, rigid framework, and they apply it.
And you know, there's speculation that China wants to take over Taiwan because of the semiconductors. Well, China was getting a lot of semiconductors. You know, TSMC has factories in China producing semiconductors. Why do we need to invade Taiwan to get semiconductors? So this kind of a incredibly antiquated thinking, it is still kind of circling among respective circles in both countries. And I have to say, this is probably more than anything that makes me sad, because
it is. It's a tragedy for people in both those places. I actually never done it for China, but I have done calculations for Russia. What would their GDP growth rate been if they basically had a normal development of capital markets, which would have required rule of law? And I won't bore you at all, but they'd literally be, you know, Russia's GDP is somewhere under $2 trillion. They'd, by my calculations, they'd be at least $1 trillion richer.
Yeah.
If they, to Deng Xiaoping's point. Anyways, we've talked a long time. This is super. Yeah. This is a great conversation. We could talk for another hour. Thank you for appearing here. This is wonderful. I'm just going to, and then, you know, if for those people who are listening, go out and buy his book. I think you'll enjoy it. And thanks so much for appearing here. And just give me a moment to just press stop and upload the recording. Thank you.